Okay, I mean, that's why I said essentially that for the presentation, I want to see your slides before you give the presentation, a week before, except for the first week, which, you know, I said I would be more flexible, except apparently there is no first week. And I don't know, I mean, it's like, so I think they should just somehow write themselves as 2.1, 2.2 or something for the rest. But there are like only 12 people. I mean, are there people whose names don't exist there? Yeah.
And I thought it was 13.
What?
I thought I had
the membership position of
13.
Is there a
13th? Was that number
13?
Yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
we did.
Yeah, you can check what the
I
didn't overwrite anyone.
There is no 13th, right? Because.
Number
13th. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, you signed up and somebody removed you. This is interesting. Let's see. Well, we have to have you are Jeff. What's your user ID? This is started here only, right? See, I started it.
Yeah, I mean, it was blank when I did it.
No, it's not signed up. See, this is the revision history, as far as I can tell. I know, but what I'm saying is, I didn't make it up. This is a revision history, and it's a wiki.
Yeah.
And, you know, so all I can say is, after you signed up, I guess you have to save. And if you did not save, then I guess that's one reason. Because there is none, as you can see. That would be extremely interesting. Then I really know that we need to do game theory in this class. because people are actually, you know, adversarial completely. No, I don't know. I don't see it there. Let's see. Okay.
Maybe you can add like.
Oh, actually, yeah. So this came. I mean, yeah. I think I.
I just added mine.
Okay.
Ago.
Did you remove somebody? Okay.
Maybe we can add an extra slot on each day, cut it down to 15 minutes per person, so that everybody else is. I don't think there are only 12 people in the class. I think there's more like 16 or 17.
No, I think only some number of people are required to give presentations. Those are the ones who are registered.
Oh, then maybe.
And I believe that is still 15, as far as I know.
Oh,
okay. But then, you know, I think the drop deadline was sometime soon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe people know what they want to do, and so I guess, I don't know. This is basically what I'm seeing here, and, you know, clearly November 6th, there's nothing going on, as far as I can tell, because it's already this week, and nobody wrote their names. I don't know, I leave it up to people who haven't signed up. I mean, I have my hands full getting my middle school son to do things. You know, I assume that graduate students, I don't have to hurt you. So you just have to deal with it. So as far as the presentations are concerned, I guess it's 1 hour, 15 minutes, and that is what, 75 minutes. And so each presentation will be 25 minutes. Each presentation will be 25 minutes. I guess if basically you need to, my suggestion would be you give at least a couple of slides. I mean, after 25 minutes, you should at least probably spend 5 to 6 minutes connecting where people are to where this paper is. Okay, as to why this is a relevant problem. I mean, obviously you are reading this. Otherwise, how does it? You know, it's like there is no. I mean, you have an idea of what people know in this class based on what happened in the class, and should at least make some connection to what this paper is saying and why it is connected to anything that's going on, and then talk about basically what the paper does, I guess, what would be its main contribution and why it's interesting. And I would be looking at the presentation in terms of, if I understand the paper based on your presentation, then you did a good presentation. That's the thing, right? If I understand, if you understand something in the textbook based on my lecture, then I did a good lecture. Otherwise, I didn't. And the same thing for you, right? Yes.
Juan and I were just having a discussion. Do you want to present a paper or a topic? Because some of us have a bunch of papers, like 2 or 3.
It's I think originally I said you can pick up to 2 papers,
yeah,
right? It's okay to do a topic, but I'm assuming that people will have a harder time finding a topic than a paper. There's nothing stopping you from doing a topic. Except if topic involves just flashing a huge number of papers' names and depth is zero, then that would be bad. Yes?
So I'm focusing on one paper now. Is that okay?
That's fine. As long as you make sense of, you know, rather than just give the, in an actual conference, that paper would just probably directly start off, you know, saying this is my introduction, this is my motivation, no, next thing. I would prefer in the class, since it, other people should understand what you're saying, I would prefer that you spend a little more time in motivating the paper, and especially if you are in one of the topics that hasn't yet been covered at all in the class or would not be covered in the class. Okay? And so you are teaching, and presumably I understand that 591 students teach themselves and they're extremely smart because of this. So you are going to teach yourself except outside of the class time. And I will be serious, you are supposed to show up, you know, and maybe what we should do is each of you, okay, also each of you should have a final slide. I think this is a good thing to do. Final slide, 5 things you should know about this paper, okay? And if nothing else, at least they should understand those. And then if there is a second sanity test, for example, the next sanity test, for example, there's insane performance on that, I'll have to have one more sanity test, let's say. Then I could use, you know, what you're supposed to know from all these presentations, and I can check whether you understood this. Okay? I'm not necessarily saying that would happen, but I think that would be a good thing to have as to. And, you know, you don't necessarily have to completely specify all the details of the paper, but it would be very much useful. It would be very much useful. I mean, in fact, in a conference presentation, people say that the reason a presentation is supposed to, what it's supposed to do is sell the paper so that people will go home, open the proceedings, and read the paper. So it's supposed to be an advertisement. Okay, I would not necessarily think that would be that your, I mean, that would not be a bad model for your presentation as to why you should read this paper. Okay, it's only most of you are talking about Ichikai papers. They're 6 pages long. Okay, apart from explaining exactly what was done in the paper, you know, you could also actually just get people to read the paper. That would be, then you would have succeeded. Okay, I have no obvious expectations as to how this is going to happen. I mean, I'm not a huge big believer in these presentation-based courses. That's why I did not run my course that way, although it would be much easier for me. You know, I just sit, instead of you guys sleeping, I sleep sitting in the back, and it's much better for me. I've decided that, you know, it takes some time to get maturity, to understand the topic, to explain it. And my hope is, rather than you just present it, you at least show me your slides with, you know, enough time. And as I said, you know, you should send me your slides a week before, and you should make sure that you meet me in the office hours one of the office hours of that week, so that, you know, I can go over and make sure that, you know, these things make sense, and then you present it on Friday. Okay? What, any other questions? Next, as I said, I sent a mail saying this week I will not be actually holding office hours, because right after this class I have to teach a 471 class just for this week. But, you know, if you have to talk to me, send me an email, and, you know, I'll make sure that I'll find time to talk to you guys. But, I mean, again, after that class I'll be back in my office. But if that would be over, I think 3:30 to 4:45, But some other time, if this doesn't work, and you know, some other time you need to meet me, that would be fine too. Okay, but that's the thing. And then next Monday, as I said, I would be away, and I will give you guys an in-class exam. And as I said, everybody who is sitting in has to take that test, including those who are registered. Okay. And this is really to get an idea for me as well as for yourself as to whether we are talking the same language or not. And if we are not, you know, I probably should repeat the whole semester, so that way I don't have to prepare anything for the second half of the semester. If you are, then it's good. Okay. That's on Monday, and it will be in class, it will be closed book. And so whatever you understood, you understood. And obviously that also means that I'm not going to ask you questions I would only ask certain types of questions. For example, you know, when you find somebody, when you cross paths with somebody in a conference and they are working in reinforcement learning, you want to make intelligent conversation, right? You should be able to say a few sentences without them laughing at your face. And those are the sentences I'm going to check, for example. Okay, so I'm really getting to see whether anything went through, kind of a thing. So I assume that everybody would get 100%, and I would be happy, you would be happy. If we don't, then I would be worried. You know, that's the thing. Okay. I assume that the test much less than what has actually been done in the class. What has actually been done in the class, yes. Final project, there is no separate presentation time schedule as of now, so you should definitely give me a report, and I don't have any time separated, especially given that these presentations are going all the way to the end, okay? So as of now, there are no separate presentation time slots for the final project. You would have a report that I would read, and then you can make it available on the web, other people can read it too. Okay. That might change if people get done fast enough and I got done with all the topics I want to do, then maybe in the last one or two real classes, we might have a presentation. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, what I'm going to do today is basically conclude the dynamic based networks, and I did also send you a reading. I mean, next class is up in the air because I realized that the write up on the relational models isn't detailed enough to really get anything out of it. In the chapter that I sent you. Okay, I'm thinking for this next class. So today it may well be that I will say a few words about how the relational models are connected to dynamic based networks with an example. I thought I've said that already last time. To go into more details, that description is not enough. Stuart Russell's description is not enough, unfortunately. So I am probably going to have to do it later. One idea is to actually. I have to reprioritize, and if we do relational probabilistic models, then I would probably want to do the Markov logic networks, which there is a nice little book that you can read. But there is also, in fact, I'm at this point not very clear as to what I would be doing on Wednesday, which is kind of sad. But I think one thing that I'm considering doing is that the models, relational models as well as dynamic based networks, they will wind up requiring you to understand how to learn the network structure. We mostly focused on the inference part, and we need to start talking about learning, and that's one topic that I haven't looked at in this course. And given that this is a shoulder class, in the sense I would be doing on Wednesday and then coming back next Wednesday, one idea that I'm considering is go through the foundations of statistical learning. How many of you have done machine learning courses? Okay, how many? So I would probably send a note over this evening. For example, whether you know the background on MLE versus MAP versus Bayesian learning, whether you know the difference between discriminative versus generative learning, whether you know the idea of learning as optimization, whether you know bias, variance, trade-off, is it worth doing it for a class? Okay, that's the issue. I know that I don't do it in 471, and so I don't mind doing it here. There is a good chapter on that in Russell's book, and it's also, I found a much nicer write-up actually in one of the more recent books by Kohler and Friedman on probabilistic graphical models. So that's my current idea as to what might happen on Wednesday. Okay. And any of you who think it'll be repetition, too much of a repetition for you, please send me an email. And if a majority say so, then I would decide not to do that and try and do something else. Okay. Any questions on this dynamic Bayes network stuff? So we were talking about the fact that all the inference tasks in the DBNs will be essentially about the posterior distributions over state variables. Okay. And so, for example, these are normally it's all about the state variables, which are hidden. Okay. And evidence variables are available. Now, in fact, if the state is actually fully observable, then it's still basically the dynamic Bayes networks where there's only one state variable that's fully observable, those are basically called Markov chains. Okay, so you know exactly what the state is. And you would assume that even if you do have a Markov chain, you can say, so for example, x0 gets you to x1, which gets you to x2, which gets you to x3. These are all, you know, the state variables value at those time points. And then if you want to say that the entire state can be observed, this is the evidence. You could do that. And that way you can still say dynamic Bayes networks, you are always only considering posteriors over the state variables and not over the evidence variables. Okay. In the Markov chain, basically, they are the same because the entire state is observable. Okay. So we talked about the part that we are mostly interested in is filtering. Okay, prediction and smoothing and most likely explanation are other kinds of inferences that are also very relevant with dynamic Bayes networks, or temporal probabilistic models. But we would not focus on them. You know, I think if you read the chapter, you know how they are done. But I won't discuss them directly here. Okay. So now the question is, how do you do inference in dynamic Bayes networks? The naive method is essentially that if you have this network, you can unroll it to whatever level you need. So for example, you are at the time step 17 and you need to know what state you are in. So you essentially unroll this network starting with 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. up to 17. Okay. And then at that point, now you're trying to get the posterior distribution over the state variables at the 17th time step. Okay, now, however, this is a direct Bayes network. This is a Bayes network, right? So you could just use the Bayes network inference techniques that you already know to solve this problem. And there are two types of inference techniques that you learned about in Bayes networks, right? One is exact inference algorithms, the other is the approximate inference algorithms. Approximate inference algorithms are based on sampling. Okay. So what we are basically going to say is that while you could do this, this is the zeroth order thing you can always do. Okay. And in some sense, this can also be done for PRMs. I'll show you at least an example of a PRM, RPM, or relational probabilistic model. And you can then say, if you, for example, wound up evaluating this network, then the whole point of DBM is just that it makes the specification easy, nothing else. Inference is no easier, specification is easy. Right? But that's not bad, because in fact, you know, in probabilistic reasoning, we found from the beginning that the biggest thing is the number of parameters, the number of probabilities that you have to provide. And so if in fact instead of in a 17 size network of this, you know, you can compute how many numbers you need given this structure, and you're getting by with much fewer because you know you have much basically because it's a repeated structure, so the same parameters are being repeated with just that stationarity assumption. Okay, so now notice the levels of saving. In fact, if you have 17 levels, let's say if you have 5 levels, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, in 11 Boolean variables, right? If you have 11 Boolean variables, that the number of numbers you actually need to present the joint distribution is 2 power 11 minus 1. And because it's a Bayes network like this, it would be much less than 2 power 11 minus 1. Right, because it will just be 2 plus, so 1 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2, all these, just add them up. Those are the only parameters you wound up needing. So compared to 2 power 11 minus 1, just finding these is a huge advantage from a Bayes network point of view. Now, but compared to these many, just getting by with this is even better advantage. And as I said, in learning, if you, you know, if you have a certain amount of data, then you can get these many parameters much more easily from that data, as against, you know, the full set of parameters. So specification being made simpler is not a bad thing at all, okay? But you would like to see if inference also could be made simpler. Now, if in terms of making the inference simpler, the two ideas would be basically you have to use the repetitive structure of the network and see if you can customize the normal Bayes network algorithms. Okay, so in terms of the exact algorithms, for example, you know, remember there was the variable elimination method, which was a standard method for the Bayes network inference. It turns out that one idea would be that in essence, you unroll the network one level forward and roll up the network behind you. Okay, so that you always have only two slices. So first you are at 0 and 1, and then you expand 1 to 2, and then you roll over 0. So now it's only 1 and 2, and then 2 and 3, and 3 and 4. And this way you come up to, you know, 17th step. Okay, see, it basically in doing that, it's sort of like a variable elimination, a specific variable elimination order. And if you remember from the variable elimination, the question is what order should you eliminate variables in? And for dynamic Bayes networks, it turns out there is a pretty obvious order. It's the temporal order in which you eliminate them. Okay? So specialized variable elimination method, unfold the t plus 1th level and roll up the t-th level. So that you're always, you know, in the memory you only have a two-slice Bayes network. You always only have a two-slice Bayes network. Okay? The other, so we'll talk about that first, and then we'll talk about approximate methods. Okay, so this would be basically what we'll be looking at here would be a version of, it can be seen as a version of variable elimination approach, which is sort of suited to the dynamic Bayes networks. Okay, that's the filtering algorithm that he talked about in the beginning. The other is essentially doing sampling. Okay. And in the case of sampling, we looked at a bunch of methods when we did Bayes networks. One is rejection sampling, one is likelihood weighting, one is Markov chain Monte Carlo. And it turns out likelihood weighting can be very nicely generalized to dynamic Bayes networks so that it actually uses the structure. Okay, and that is a very powerful idea called particle filters. Okay, so we'll talk about that. So those are the two main things we'll do today. Okay, so now, in terms of the exact inference, basically, essentially what you're doing is you are trying to compute this, right? X of t plus 1 given the evidence all the way from 1 to t plus 1. Right? I mean, remember the way the thing is, 0th level, there is no evidence. So the evidence starts at the first level, and you are looking for the posterior at the 17th level. So this is what you want to compute. This is the posterior distribution you want to compute. And so the idea is to somehow try and write this posterior distribution as some sort of a recursive computation, which depends only on the evidence at the T plus 1th level and the posterior at the teeth level. If you do this, then you can do this business of roll forward, unroll forward, and then roll up behind you. Right? That's basically what you're going to do. Now, to do this, what we'll do is we'll actually use the Bayes network structure. Okay? So these steps you should be able to understand essentially. X of t plus 1 given evidence 1 to t plus 1. This is just a shorthand notation for E1 and E2 and E3, etc., up to ET plus 1. Okay, so this conjunction can be written as just 1 to t and t plus 1. Okay, so this would look like P, A given B and C. And you can use Bayes rule to write A given B and C is P, B and C given A, right? And then normalize that. Okay? So in this case, what you're doing is you're writing this as E T plus 1 given X T plus 1 and E 1 T, and then X T plus 1 given E 1 T. Okay, this is just direct Bayes rule. Nothing that you haven't done anything new. Okay? At this point, you remember the structure. The structure essentially is that at the xt plus 1, you are saying I wish that picture was there, but so at the xt plus 1, so you are saying et plus 1 given xt plus 1 and all the previous evidences. So you are saying the distribution of umbrella 5 given rain 5 and all the other evidences. Now, this is a Bayes network. In the Bayes network, given your immediate parent, all the evidences are their ancestors, right? Even though it's written this way, if you look at it as, you can actually write this top to bottom, and then you can see that umbrella 5 as its ancestor, umbrella 4. Okay, all the ancestors are blocked given rain 5. That's the whole definition of Bayes network independence, right? Okay, so given that, you essentially can say that this xt plus 1 and e1t is nothing but just xt plus 1. The evidences don't matter because given the state, then the evidence doesn't have any more impact on you. Okay, and then this is of course still xt plus 1 given e1t. Okay, so now this is good. Et plus 1 given xt plus 1, this, what is this? This, by stationarity assumption, it's ET given XT. It's the same one, this is the sensor model. Right? To provide this, this is this particular CPT. Okay? What's the probability that umbrella is true given rain is true? What's the probability that umbrella is true given rain is false? You provided that as part of the network. Notice actually that up to here you did not use, up until here you have not used the stationarity assumption. When you say ET plus 1 given XT plus 1 is the same as ET given XT is the same as ET minus 1 given XT minus 1, they're all the same numbers, that's where you use the stationarity assumption. Okay, so you know this number, this is the sensor model. Okay, and then the other one is this XT plus 1 given the evidence up to T. Okay, now what's interesting is if you look at the network, you're saying what is the posterior distribution of rain 5 given all these evidences? And the best way to do it is rain 5 is immediately affected by rain 4. So let's write everything, all these evidences affect on rain 4, and then rain 4 affect on rain 5. That's how you get the posterior of rain 4. Because this guy does not affect this guy other than through this. Similarly, this guy does not affect this guy other than through this. Okay? So again, using the network structure, what you need to do is you sum over rain 4. Okay? You sum over the various possible values of rain 4. Okay? That's exactly what you wind up doing to get this xt plus 1. So you write this again, xt plus 1 given e1 to t plus 1 is this stuff, And this one is essentially what you're doing is xt plus 1 given e1 to t can be summed over xt for various values of xt. You can always marginalize, you can always, you know, consider for different values of xt, xt plus 1 given xt and this, okay, times probability that xt given e1 t. Right, this is a, you know, that, and all you're doing essentially is you're summing over this middle variable xt. Now the advantage is that once you do this, xt plus 1 given xt, e1 t will become xt plus 1 given xt. Because again, given the Bayes network structure, in the Bayes network structure, rain 5 given rain 4 and all the evidence is nothing but rain 5 given rain 4. Because everything else is an ancestor. It's a very powerful, you know, independence assumption that is present there. Okay? So because of which, then you can say this is nothing but xt plus 1 given xt. And then xt given e1t. Okay. Now this part, this is xt plus 1 given xt is the same as xt given xt minus 1, is the same as x1 given x0, is the same as x2 given x1. It's the transition model, the single transition model. Okay. So you only actually had two numbers, two CPTs. One was the sensor model, one is the transition model. Thankfully, you have now written this into a recursive equation where xt plus 1 given e1 to t plus 1 is written as xt is something times xt given e1 to, you know, evidence 1 to t. Okay, and the only other numbers in this equation essentially are this is your sensor model and this is your transition model. Okay, so the advantage of this essentially is that you can, however big the network is, to compute posterior at a time step t plus 1, you essentially wind up doing work that's linear in the time. Okay, and furthermore, you're only remembering two slices, you know, t1, first t0, t1, then t1, t2, t2, 3, t3, and so on. Okay, and so, yeah, and another one way of thinking about what's going on is that this is actually going to be computed in the forward direction. If you compute it in the forward direction, then you can say that if you had this already computed, that was a matrix of XT's distribution given all the evidence up until now, that matrix is being modulated by the sensor model and the transition model to get the new matrix for the new distribution for the t plus 1. So while I wrote this in the forward direction, while I wrote it in the backward direction, xt plus 1 in terms of xt, you can use this in the forward direction. Okay, because if you are at the zeroth level, what is your posterior? You know, that's the prior. If you're on the first level, what's your posterior? It would be essentially you already have the zeroth level. Use the transition model to get what you expect x1 to be, just based on the transition probabilities, and then scale them down based on what the evidence is saying. And then alpha essentially is saying that if you get two numbers, then make sure that those two numbers add up. If it's a Boolean state and you get two numbers, make sure that the two numbers add up. Okay, so this is basically, I mean, for those of you who understood what the book is saying, this is kind of a slow repetition. And for those of you who didn't, it might be hopefully, you know, slightly more useful. In the sense, what you're doing is, he talks about this forward propagation, the message passing. The message that's being passed is that. Okay, as an example, this is an example right now. Okay, so suppose I want to actually compute the posterior for rain 2. Okay, given that umbrella 1 is true and umbrella 2 is true. Okay, and the a priori rain 0 is 0.5, that means it's, you know, 50% chance of raining today. I mean, and 0th day. Okay, so then if it is 50% chance of raining 0th day, given the, I can't see this, but I mean, let me see if there is a big, okay, given these numbers, which is the transition number, Okay, if it is raining before, with 0.7 probability it will still continue to rain. If it is not raining before, with 0.3 probability it will continue to rain. Okay, so given that, you can actually compute, given the distribution here, using the transition matrix, you can compute the distribution here. And in this case, obviously, it will still be 0.5, 0.5. Okay, but you can actually do the multiplications and convince yourself. Okay, so at this point, this is what you are expecting based on your transition model. Now then, you look at the evidence. Evidence is saying umbrella is true. Okay, then what you are supposed to do is you are going to multiply the probability that umbrella is true given rain and probability that umbrella is true given not rain. And obviously the umbrella true given not rain is going to be a smaller number. I mean, assuming you live in the kind of world I am living in. Okay, and umbrella true given rain would be a bigger number. So the effect of this is that the probability for rain is going to be increased, the probability for not rain is going to be reduced, because the rain is consistent with the evidence, not rain is not consistent with the evidence. Okay, that's basically what you do. So it's actually, in fact, it's 0.5 times, let's see what is the number. Okay, it's going to be 0.5 times 0.9, 0.5 times 0.9 is one number, and then 0.5 times 0.2 is the other number. Okay, and those two numbers will then be normalized so that they'll add up to 1. And if you do that, you'll get 0.818 and 0.182. Okay, so essentially that's the step. So you did actually just send the distribution of the state. That's the message sent forward. Okay, distribution of the state given all the evidence until now is the message that's being sent forward. Okay, so now this is going to be sent forward to the next level. Okay, so 0.818 and 0.182, and then given that if it is raining, it will continue to rain. And if it's not raining, it will basically not rain as much next time. Okay, but so if you remember the numbers, essentially, if it's not raining, there is still a 30% chance that it will rain next day. So the effect of this transition matrix is to slightly increase the uncertainty. Okay, and I want you to understand, obviously, that this distribution is less uncertain than this, right? This is more rainy. Here it's both equally likely. This is more rainy. After the transition, you actually get, it's still 0.62, 0.37, but this is less rainy than here. So in fact, this distribution has more uncertainty. In general, in fact, if you just keep whatever is your transition model, as long as the transition model is stochastic, it's not deterministic, that means it doesn't just it has a probability. Given the rain is true, the probability that it will rain tomorrow is not 1. And given it's not raining, the probability that it would rain tomorrow is not 1 or 0. It's between 1 and 0. If you have any uncertainty at all, then if you just keep projecting it forward into the future, okay, at some point of time, essentially you will reach the steady state distribution of the rain and not rain. Okay, and that would be the steady state distribution of the Markov chain. So if you don't look at the evidence, and if you just keep propagating, so if you don't look at the evidence, you're not doing this part. Okay, so if you're doing prediction, whatever, wherever you are, and you're just doing this top level part. Okay, as you keep doing this, you will at some point of time reach steady state distribution. That's the Markov chain stationary distribution. You know, the same thing for page rank, it will be the page rank. It is some, you know, you, in this particular case, it is the stationary distribution that, you know, after a long period of time, a particular day would be raining versus not raining. That only depends on the transition matrix. Okay? And it doesn't depend upon the prior probabilities anymore. It only depends on the transition matrix. Okay, and the faster you get to the steady state, the, you say the mixing time, you know, the time, the number of time steps you need to go before, once you reach the mixing time, then there is no point in predicting. Beyond the mixing time, predicting doesn't change the probability because you already reached the fixed point. Do you see what I'm saying? So suppose I'm at the zeroth level, you know, by about seventh level, I reach the stationary distribution. Then there is no point in predicting what will be true at the 15th level or 29th level or 3000th level because the same exact thing will be true.
So you're saying that
they,
when you reach steady state, the number
will
become closer and closer?
Well, no, in the state, there is a steady, given any Markov chain, there is a stationary distribution that's corresponding to the primary eigenvector. Okay? Now, the interesting point is, how fast does the Markov chain, you know, reach its steady state distribution as you keep doing the, when you're doing projection, essentially you are just, you know, simulating the Markov chain step by step by step. Okay? The faster it reaches the mixing time, is that the better or worse for you? This is a very interesting, I mean, you have already a lot of, some of you here have pretty big intuitions about stationary distribution probabilities and page ranks. Okay, the faster a Markov chain mixes, is it better or worse for PageRank algorithm?
Better.
Better. I'm doing filtering. The faster my Markov chain mixes, is it better or worse for me, the agent? Better or worse for me, the agent? Think before answering. Remember, the moment I hit the stationary distribution, I cannot predict any more about the future. Do you see? Okay, once I reach that steady state distribution, that's the same thing that will just keep repeating. So my prediction has a window, essentially. Up to that point, I can tell you, oh, if in five steps, this is the distribution. In six steps, this is the distribution. Seven steps, I reach the steady state. Eight steps, the same. Nine steps, the same. 10 steps, the same. So if you want to be able to actually predict far into the future, you want shorter mixing, the longer mixing times. Okay, in the page rank, you are considering the computation time. That's why you want faster mixing time. Okay, so the book talks about this whole issue of mixing times, and you know, if all you are doing is predicting into the future, the moment you know Markov chain mixes, you have no more predictive ability. You see what I'm saying? I can give you a. For example, think about the worst possible scenario. If my transition model is 0.5, 0.5, okay, and I started with 0.5, 0.5, then it will always be 0.5, 0.5, 0.5, 0.5, 0.5. So I have no predictive power at all. Okay, all the predictive power is coming partly from transition matrix until it mixes, but then the real big savior for you is the evidence, which sets you back on track. This is what I was expecting, but then this is what the ground truth is saying, so I revise my belief. Without evidence, it makes, you know, obviously, you know, you can do filtering. When you're doing filtering, you do take evidence into account. Okay? Now, of course, you know, so in this particular case, I go from here, I got a 0.627, 0.373. The point I was making is, notice that it became more uncertain than here. Okay, and then again it improves. So projection always makes it more uncertain. Projection part makes it more uncertain, and the evidence part tends to make it less uncertain because it will basically change the probability such that the parts that are consistent with the evidence are given higher probability. So again, in this case, after you saw umbrella 2 again, you got 0.883 and 0.117. The same, the way you got it is 0.627 times 0.9, 0.373 times 0.2, you get two numbers and you normalize them such that those two numbers will add up to one. So each number is divided by the sum of both the numbers, and that's what you got. Yes, sir. Because it's essentially, if you are in, so the probability that you are in rain 1 is 0.818, and if you are in rain 1, then you will still be in rain 1 with 0.7. Yes.
So why is it 0.5, 0.5 range, 0.5, 0.5, 0.5?
Because again, remember that to get this 0.5, 0.5, you have to consider it's raining and it continued to rain. That's 0.5 times 0.7, and it was not raining and it started raining, which 0.5 times 0.3. So this 0.5 times 0.7 plus 0.3, which is 0.5. Did you get that? Right? I mean, the idea is it's not that only raining will contribute to raining and not raining will only contribute to not raining. That would be too good a world. If it was raining, with 0.7 probability, it will still rain. So essentially, it's matrix multiplication. Right? Except it has semantics, because if it is raining, that probability that it's raining is 0.5. times it, if it is raining today, it will continue to rain tomorrow, is 0.7. So 0.5 times 0.7 is one way of raining. Another way of raining is it wasn't raining yesterday, but it's raining today. So 0.5 times 0.3. So 0.5 times, 0.7 plus 0.3. That's why it became again 0.5. Okay? So that's what they were saying. And this is a nice shorthand notation. But these are distributions being multiplied, and you have to make sure that you understand what the right way to do that. Okay, these are all distributions, not single probabilities. So that means you have to do this for each probability. Okay. Now the advantage, as I said, is essentially you're doing it like in this forward one message at a time. So you only are sending, you're only sending as the message. They only sending as the message the state distribution. How bad can that be? Well, it won't be bad if you have a single state and it's discrete, it's Boolean, in which case you'll always be sending two numbers out. Suppose I have a single state variable, but it's continuous. What happens? I still have to send this continuous variables distribution from place to place to place to place, from one next next level, next level, next level. What happens? Your continuous distribution, so that if it's a Boolean variable, its full distribution will always require exactly two numbers. It'll never worsen. If you have a continuous state variable, single, now I'm talking about single continuous, okay? So originally, let's say the state variable looked like this. Oh, I can specify it as a simple. No, first of all, the problem is that extensional description of a distribution of a continuous variable will kill you. Right? Because you have to give every possible value what's the probability. So you need to provide the probability density. Right? And this is why when you learn continuous variables first, when you learn continuous variables first in your statistics and probability classes, you never talked about basically these tabular representations for probabilities. You provide a closed form representation for the density. Okay? If you provide a closed form representation for the density, so for example, I say in the beginning, it is like a normal curve. It turns out that normal curve requires just two numbers to specify, the mean and the variance, and you plug it into the normal distribution, it will provide you the infinite number of densities. Right? That's what we've always known in continuous variables. Now the problem, of course, is in this case, while you're going from one state to another state to another state, the distribution is what is being sent, the distribution will only have two numbers. Here, what you have is you have a distribution in some closed form, with let's say k parameters, and when you do one level filtering, it might become like that. It might require 10 parameters. One more level filtering, it might become like that. You need 29 parameters. One more filtering, it might look like this, and you'll get the number of parameters just keep increasing to just specify exactly the distribution. Right? So in the case of continuous variables, saying I just have to send the distribution from state to state to state isn't particularly reassuring. because the distribution can become very non-uniform, I mean, become very irregular, and there is no simple function, and you need to provide some sort of a piecewise approximation, and you need to provide a huge big approximation. Okay? Then this is exactly the reason why we'll get to Kalman filters. The reason Kalman filters are interesting is that there exists one magic distribution, okay, which is normal distribution. There may be others, but definitely magic distribution, normal distribution. If your distribution, suppose rain 1, rain 2, etc., instead of rain 0, rain 1, and rain 2, if you, this is position 1, position 0, position 1, position 2 of an airplane. And these are, you know, camera shots of where it is, or the noise level as to where it is. So the evidences are giving you information about the position, which is a continuous variable. Okay? Then this distribution, initial distribution, has to be provided. And then you need to provide the transition distribution, which is, you know, conditional on the previous state. And you need to provide the evidence distribution, which is conditional on the previous state, what is the evidence value. If it so happens that you can provide all those three as normal distribution, then it turns out that when you project a normal distribution over a normal transition function, you get a normal distribution, which will still be specifiable in two numbers. And then if you take a normal distribution and then you, you know, make it consistent with evidence, which is also normal distribution, that will again give you another normal distribution. It still has only two parameters. All that winds up happening is the mu's and sigmas will wind up having more complex parameters, complex formulas to be computed based on the mu's and sigmas of the priors and the transition matrix. But that's such a small price to pay, because you have the distribution itself only requires two parameters, and you just send two parameters from next state to state to state to state. Okay, so to put this in perspective, so that's why Kalman filters are hugely popular. Okay, because the Kalman filters are like naive Bayes networks, okay, for signal processing people. So most things are not normal distribution, but we'll just make an assumption of normal distribution because it's so much easier to solve them, way so much easier to solve. And they're so darned easy to solve that suppose I have a continuous variable which I have discretized it into 15 values. So now I can either use it as sending the 2 power 15 distribution table, right? I can send the 15 distribution table, or I can send the mu sigmas. So go back to it as a continuous variable. You are better off using continuous variable rather than using the discretized version. And what is the point in discretizing it if you're going to lose accuracy? Anyway, you're going to lose accuracy. And if you're also paying more time, more computational cost, why would you do it? The only reason you would not do Kalman filtering is if, in fact, the transition function and the evidence function are so abnormal, that means they are not at all close to Gaussian, that you get really bad results. Okay? Even in those cases, sometimes what happens is a part of the transition function can be seen as normal. I mean, let's say one of the things, like the evidence might be normal, whereas transition may be non-normal Gaussian function. In those cases, what they'll wind up doing is they'll combine what you can do with Kalman, you would use Kalman. And what you would do where you can't make the Kalman filter, you know, assumption, you do particle filters, which is the next idea we'll talk about. And if you use Kalman and particle filters together, that's one place my name becomes famous, because there is an idea called Rao-Blackwell filter. Okay? And it's the wrong Rao, not me. But there's a Rao who essentially found this great way of combining, you know, particle filters for the discrete, the non-Gaussian part, and then use Kalman filters for the Gaussian part. Okay? So you have to understand, I mean, I don't know, it took me a while when I first heard about Kalman filters versus, you know, filtering. So why is it a big deal, you know? why can't I just send the distribution along? And you cannot send the distribution along if you have continuous variables, because the distribution can become quite irregular, so that it requires a huge number of parameters. In the worst case, how many parameters does it require? Infinite number. Right? Okay. So that's the connection between this part and the Kalman filtering part. Where you can use Kalman filters, you still should use it. Okay. For the discrete variables, if the variable was originally discrete to begin with, what they call categorical attributes, like rain is yes, rain is no. Okay. Then you may as well use the, you can't do a continuous approximation in that case. Okay. If you can make a continuous approximation and it is connected to something close to Gaussian, you use Kalman filters. Okay. And then I may not actually get to Kalman filters the speed at which I'm going. I'm only probably going to complete the particle filters today. So let me point out to you that this distribution essentially will be, if you are Kalman filters, those distributions would be essentially the new values of mu and sigma. Okay. In fact, I'll go forward many slides and show you the formulas. Okay, so this is basically what it's saying, that if the original PXT given E1 to T is a Gaussian, then this integration is the summation for the continuous variables, right? Or the R summation is the integration for the continuous variables. All of you took calculus before you took computer science. And so really I should say summation is integration for the discrete variables. But you have to integrate over all the middle states XT, right? This integration will also be a Gaussian with slightly different mu and sigma. Okay? And then furthermore, if XT plus 1 given E1T is a Gaussian, then the updated distribution, which is probability of ET plus 1 given XT plus 1 and probability XT plus 1 given ET, this is Gaussian, multiplication of those two will again be a Gaussian. Because of which, after two steps, you'll still be a Gaussian. And moreover, in fact, this is a nice little picture which shows that at x0, you may have, you have thought this is basically a linear scenario where you could be anywhere. X position could be anywhere here. In the beginning, you thought you are kind of somewhere here. So it's more likely to be here. And as you go this side and this side, it exponentially falls down. Okay? And then, that's the prior. And then the transition again is a Gaussian. If the transition is a Gaussian, notice what happened. The new Gaussian will be like this most of the time, just as what I showed in the previous example. Most of the time, projection increases the uncertainty. Future has to become less and less certain. Otherwise, it's not fun. Okay? And then you look at the evidence, multiply the evidence thing with this. And then you renormalize, you get a new Gaussian. Notice this one is peaked. It's much narrower. Narrow means obviously it has less uncertainty. The variance smaller means less uncertainty. So by this time, you know pretty much that you are kind of in this area. In the beginning, you thought you are somewhere in this area. And then when you projected, you could be somewhere in this area. And then when you looked at the evidence, you got your bearings back again. Now, what is wrong with this? The problem is, what if your probability, original probability, for example, I left my keys, this is what the book says, my prior distribution of my keys, I left them either at home or office. Okay? Or I left it in this place or in that place. Now, how do I fit a Gaussian for this distribution? What I really need is a bimodal distribution. It's sight of more likely here, more likely there, less everywhere else. If you make a bimodal distribution to a unimodal distribution, essentially, you'll have to put a big thing in the middle like this, which is why he says, you will then say the keys are hanging in the air somewhere between the two places with the most likely probability. Now, obviously, if you model your world that way, then your answers are going to be inaccurate. You see? So, this is why Kalman filter can fail, just as Naive-Bayes, filters, naive Bayes classifiers can fail when their assumptions fail. Kalman filters can fail when their assumptions fail. However, any of these extremely simple ideas which lived long enough that they're named after somebody and people still remember them, it's because even though they're making crazy assumptions, most of the time their assumptions are more or less satisfied. Even when they're not truly satisfied, their predictions are much better than, you know, are not really that bad, essentially. So that's part of the deal with the Kalman filter. And then one other thing I want to show you is, there should be a slide which, if I can show you, it's just to give you an idea. There is a nice little way in which I forgot, I just didn't notice. I was looking only at the bottom, I didn't look at the pink and the top. So the nice thing is the mu t plus 1 and sigma t plus 1 are essentially in terms of the mu's and sigmas of the evidence matrix, the evidence normal distribution, prior normal distribution, and transition normal distribution. And for this, you don't need, this is silly, right? Because this is just, all you need is a little calculator to compute the new mu and sigma. And Kalman filtering is done online most of the time. In fact, it was invented to do target tracking. Okay, so if a plane is going and you're getting, you know, uncertain observation of its places, okay, then where do you think the plane would be after a while? Why is this important? Because that's where you should shoot, not where the plane is currently. Because this, your little missile takes its own time going up. And it better be in the same place where the plane would be when it reaches that elevation. So Kalman filter, everything unfortunately has been developed because of military, you know, because we're interested in killing each other. And so Kalman filtering was developed as part of target tracking. Okay? And it has to be done online. You know, you can't say, okay, give me the thing, I'll put it in MATLAB and come back tomorrow and tell you where you would be. It's not going to help. And it is extremely easy to do because this is just, you know, recomputation of the mu's and sigmas. Compared to this, this is much harder. Especially imagine an n-valued state variable, even if it's a single state variable but n values. Then, you know, you need to do a huge amount of computation just to go from step to step. It's not as simple as that other one, okay? So in this is one case where actually continuous versions have a nicer property sometimes. And this is not the only case. There are scenarios in computer science where you take a discrete problem, find a continuous version of that, and that's cheaper to solve. You know, the classic case is integer and linear programming. You know, finding integral solutions that satisfy a set of linear constraints is harder than finding the fractional solutions that satisfy a set of linear constraints. Okay? Now, the next thing I want to do essentially is doing the likelihood weighting, which is, remember I said, apart from the exact, I want to do, you know, the approximate version of inference. Now, approximate versions of inference for Bayes networks, I'm just going to remind you very quickly that likelihood weighting went this way. Suppose you had this cloudy sprinkler, rain, and wet grass scenario. And the thing that likelihood weighting was trying to do, and in essence, the million-dollar question in any sampling-based inference technique is how not to use too many samples. Use few samples and get good results is what the big deal is. If you can use infinite number of samples, yes, you're going to get completely accurate results. Okay? And before we came to likelihood weighting, we looked at rejection sampling, which essentially, as it, you know, simulates the Bayes network, as soon as the current sample becomes inconsistent with the evidence, it throws that sample out because it doesn't contribute to the denominator, it doesn't contribute to the numerator. Okay? If you don't contribute to either, then essentially it's useless. Okay? However, in the likelihood weighting, what you do is you avoid actually sampling the evidence variables, because if you sample, it might be inconsistent with the evidence variable. Instead, you clamp the evidence variables to what their value is and say that in order to make my current sample be consistent with the evidence, I'm taking a hit. I won't count it as a full sample, I count it as a 0.5 sample or 0.3 sample, where that number comes from the CPT. Okay? In particular, suppose I'm doing this, I'm trying to sample from this network, cloudy, I sample cloudy, so I'm going to sample cloudy because these are the only evidence variables and they're green, that means they're both true in the current problem that you're trying to solve. Evidence was given to be true. Okay? Sprinkler is on and vectors is on. So now you're going to sample cloudy. So you tossed a coin which comes heads 0.5 times and tails 0.5 probability. And if it and then it so happened that it came heads. Now because it came heads, I need to keep the sprinkler true. If cloudy is true, sprinkler being true is very low probability, 0.10. So in order to be consistent with this bad evidence, I will reduce my worth from one sample to 0.1 sample. Okay, essentially the value of the weight of the sample starts with 1.0, and when I decided to take this, when I took this into account, it became 1.0 times 0.1. So the total weight now is 0.1. Okay, and then I come here, sample this because I'm doing the topological order. This one I'll really sample by actually tossing the coin, and then with a coin which comes heads 80% of the time, tails 20% of the time. Okay, now it turned out it came heads. So now by the time you came to wet grass, this is true, and wet grass has to be true because that's evidence. So look for true and see what's the number. It's 0.99. So I won't sample this. I'll just change my worth to be whatever my current worth is times 0.99. Okay? So that would be 1.0 times 0.1 times 0.99, which is 0.099. So this entire sample that I just generated is worth 0.099. And it's consistent with the evidence. Right? Now, you might say, well, I wasted a lot of sample. In fact, instead of being one sample, it became 0.099 sample. But 0.099 beats the heck out of zero, which is what you would have had if you actually just did rejection sampling. So in general, the amount of work a likelihood sampling algorithm has to do to get the same level of accuracy is significantly lower than rejection sampling. So it's a great idea. We were very happy about it when we were doing Bayes networks. Okay, and the only interesting question, of course, is it is way better than the rejection sampling, but it has its own problem. What if I have a big network, and then some 20 down levels down is where all the evidence is? So the rest of the network I will be sampling without ever having looked at the evidence. Do you see what I'm saying? And then I'll come here, and if the evidence is against me, I will be slapped really hard on my face, and my sample's value would be 10 power minus 17. Because given the samples, notice that when you sample these guys, you'll get the more likely values. And, if the lower level evidence is actually unlikely evidence, that means it's not going to be consistent with the likely values from the other places. So the probability with which you have to multiply this sample would be 10 power minus 7 or 10 power minus 25. So yes, it won't be zero valued sample, but it will be very low valued sample. Okay? So this is a problem for likelihood weighting. As good as it is, the evidence essentially might be so far down that by the time you come to it, you already did too much damage. This is sort of like, getting you do whatever you want, and then I give you a grade at the end of 10 years, by which time whatever you learned all sorts of wrong things. By giving you homeworks and stuff, which I'm not doing in this class, I can give you essentially, I can make you get, you get consistent with the evidence being said. Oh, I am so good in AI. Oh my God, my midterm grade is like 0 out of 100. Maybe I should do something else. Okay, as again as I'm so good in AI, I continue to be so good in AI, and after the entire semester is over, I have this one test where the evidence is like overwhelmingly against me. Okay, so that's when likelihood weighting fails. Unfortunately, you can't change the network configuration. You have to sample the network in the topological order. Now, this is where you are, right? Now, come to dynamic Bayes network. The interesting thing is, where is the evidence? Here. What are you going to sample? These. Are they actually at all affected by the evidence? No. So whatever is the problem we had in the likelihood weighting, it comes even more in dynamic Bayes networks. Essentially, evidence variables never affect the sampling of the range, ever. So in fact, one of the interesting things is, suppose you had, let's say, another variable here, okay, which depended on sprinkler and range. That's not an evidence variable, that's to be sampled. Then you would only sample it based on sprinkler being true, because that's already true. You would never make it inconsistent with the evidence. What you're going to do here is, everything you're sampling is not at all dependent on the evidence. So you will sample based on what the coin toss tells you, and then you look at the evidence. You do look at the evidence. It's not that you don't look at the exam. You know, you don't continue thinking I'm extremely good in AI. You will look at your grade. But you want to look at your grades beginning rather than much later in the semester. Okay? If you don't, then what happens is, most of the samples you generate will have extremely low fractional values. That means likelihood weighting takes forever to converge. Okay? So there is a version of likelihood weighting called particle filtering, which, you know, I ran out of time, so I'll talk about at least some of it in the next class, which basically what it does is, it pushes the samples around into the more likely regions by what it's called reweighting, resampling. Okay? Make sure that you read it, and then we'll discuss it next class. Okay? That's all.